Thank you. It's again a honor to be elected, and I guess following the previous two speakers, I should say a little bit about my background. I was born during the war, and so kind of traveled around for a bit, and then grew up on a farm in New Brunswick, and I think a lot of the early incentive to get into science came from my two grandfathers, and one of them ran an ice cream factory, which was a different advantage, but he used to bring me home old relays and things, and I could tear them apart and work on them, and so I got interested in engineering and things quite early. And the other grandfather was actually trained as an engineer in Scotland, but he was most interested in reading Latin poetry and things like that, and kind of odd background. Then I went to a one-room country school with eight grades in it for a while, and that in some ways had advantages, because I remember in math, or arithmetic as it was at the time, one of the teachers said, well, you had three pages of problems, but if you got the first page all done correctly, you didn't have to do the second or third, and so you could go read whatever you wanted to read. And so that was an incentive to get the problems done, one, correctly, two, in a hurry. So an interesting background. And then I went to Acadia, which is kind of where this talk starts. I should say a little bit first here, thanks to people on the Ulysses and ACE spacecraft projects, and to for data and all kinds of monitoring things and bringing the data back to ground. To Phil Jones for some of the climate data I'm going to show you a little bit of. The Royal Society, of course, the Killam Foundation, who's been letting me play for the last 2 years, Canada Research Chairs, Queen's, NSERC, and the old Bell Labs, and to my wife, who's put up with a lot over the years. So, Guan, what I do is really analyze data, and particularly time series. So anything where you get data coming along in time, daily temperature measurements, all kinds of things. You see, you know, pretty much any day you look in the financial pages, you'll see plots of time series or plots of global temperature and things. So typically what you have is, at least the simplest assumption is, you start off with a stationary process, x of t up here, t goes minus infinity, just defined in the integers for now to keep life simple. So it's a zero mean finite variance, so expected value of x squared is sigma squared, and we won't go into the multivariate or complex valued series. And you assume a spectral representation, which simply says that the observed data, all the data you've got, is a Fourier transform of something dx. And the power spectrum, which is what we want to estimate, is the expected value of dx squared. So that's the components that make up the signal at a particular frequency f. And so the spectrum is just expected value. And it's the Fourier transform of the autocovariance. It's the Wiener-Khinchin theorem, which in fact was discovered by Einstein in 1914. And so the problem is estimating the spectrum from a finite data sample. So a little history. Well, 1961, I started at Acadia, and one of the advantages of small universities, I had a job in the physics library, which was, I was majoring in physics at that point. And the job, among other things, was when new journals came in, you were supposed to put them on the shelf. And they didn't care how long you spent doing this, as long as it got done sooner or later. So I would take these and sit there at nights and try to read some of them. And one of the papers I tried to read, because it had an interesting title, was Prolet Spheroidal Wave Functions, Fourier Analysis and Uncertainty by Sapien and Landau and Pollock, which basically is the uncertainty principle and with finite borders. And I must say, as a first-year student, I don't think I absorbed very much out of it, but at least I knew it was there. And continued on. And then fourth year, there's a have to do, of course, fourth year thesis, and I'd switch to math in the meantime. And the advisor I had, Dr. Haley, said, well, you know, there's a lot of work being done in time series, but he kind of thought it was on the wrong track. And so why don't I look at that and see what's going on? I don't think my fourth year thesis contributed anything to the state of the art. But then, then you graduate, and so you got that done. And so in 1965, I started work at Bell Labs in Murray Hill, New Jersey. And but I should say a little bit is I wanted to switch to electrical engineering, and there weren't any Canadian universities that were going to take me as an electrical engineer for graduate work, because, of course, I hadn't done an undergraduate in electrical engineering. And so I went to Bell Labs, who were running their own graduate program and whose idea of what you needed in electrical engineering was much closer to what I liked. So that's where I ended up and did my graduate work there. Same year, Tukey and Cooley published the FFT algorithm. So it was kind of good timing. And of course, this first paper up here, the prolate spheroidal wave functions, the authors of that were all at Bell Labs as well. So it was an interesting spot. Then, as first, I think both speakers before said, life is pretty random when you look at it, kind of a random walk. And so the next year I got put on what was called the Millimeter Waveguide Project, still mostly doing graduate, coursework and things at that time. But the because of this random occurrence at Acadia and knowing something about autocorrelation functions and power spectrum, one of the things that they wanted to do in the Waveguide Project is use the spectrum of the geometry to predict mode conversion loss. And this was a circular waveguide. They were talking about 50 or 60 millimeters diameter. And of course, at the frequencies they were working, the wavelength was under a centimeter. And so you have lots of propagating modes, and geometric distortions will convert one mode to another. And they wanted to transmit TE01, which was the low loss mode. And so if you converted energy into a different mode, that was power lost and extra attenuation, which means you'd have to put in more repeaters, and the repeaters were a couple of $1 million each. So that was money. So anyway, by 1967, here I was computing spectra. The data had a deterministic mean value function. Had to be pre-whitened because the data tapers at the time weren't so good. And the data tapers had been published by Tukey the year before in 66. And so I heard about that and doing an FFT and then correcting for the pre-whitening. And then about 1968, might have been late 67, I don't remember exactly, I was using the prolate spheroidal wave function as a data taper with an FFT, which turned into my PhD thesis. And someplace around 1972, I tried a first multi-taper, just had two windows. And of course, if you were in a waveguide department, you knew everything came in families of special functions. And as soon as you ignored one, it would come around and bite you. So I was always wondering why just a zeroth order prolate. But we were also interested in looking at lines, i.e. periodic processes, because those are a lot of the things in the manufacturing process that we were interested in improving. And you'd get a gear or a pulley or something, and it would generate periodic ripples. And putting in the second window would split lines, so I kind of looked at that and then abandoned it temporarily, fortunately not forever. So just as an example, this is some of the early data, actually pack rat as far as data goes, so I still had some of it around. It's about 1,007 samples. This is distance along the waveguide axis in meters, and this is the distortion on the diameter, so -3 to 3 microns, so plus or minus thickness of a sheet of paper. not very much, and you know, otherwise fairly smooth curve. And of course, what you would like to know is what's going on that causes this, how do you improve it, and so on. So one of the ways you can look at things is with a time series is either the autocorrelation function or the power spectrum, and they're Fourier transforms of each other, so they've got the same information. But visually, they don't carry the same impact. They don't tell you, the autocorrelation is usually a lot less useful. In fact, John Tukey said he once knew a person who could look at an autocorrelation and tell you something about the process. He said, but there was only one person that could do that. His name was Gordon MacDonald, and he'd been killed in a level crossing in Nova Scotia. So, and we'll get to this. We'll get to this other estimate later. So, a little more on this personal history. I had a department head called Dieter Alsberg, and he called me into his office one day, and he was, you know, a little worried. And he said, you know, I can look in the literature, and there are at least 100 different ways to estimate the spectrum. And he says, what I want to know from you is which is the right way and why. And just to kind of make the point, he said, you know, and if I'm wrong, we're talking about a few percent of the U.S. GNP. So it was kind of heavy. took that one to heart. And so what we were doing is we were using the power spectra for quality control and process improvement and everything. So you identify a line in the spectrum. And if you had scrap, you were talking about basically the cost of a Volkswagen. And then there was the bigger problem, well, what happens if we finished all this and the system didn't work? Because it all depended on keeping the mode conversion properties within limits. So one of the things that was around, which I'd been using, were these so-called direct estimates introduced by John Tukey. And the first paper was in 1959. That was in kind of some gray literature, which I didn't know about till somewhat later. And then 1966, he'd actually published it in a part of a conference procedure. And basically what you did is you took the data X of N, you multiplied it by some data taper D of N, and then you Fourier transformed. And if you chose the right kind of D, this gave you an obviously better estimate. And you look at the expected value of the estimate in the true spectrum convolved with Fourier transform of the data taper all squared. And of course, you look in the literature, and there are at least 50 different Ds all claimed to be optimal. And so some probably weren't quite so optimum as others. But so that was kind of a state of the art. Now, just to show you the difference this made, this is that same diameter data. If you just take the straight Fourier transform, the periodogram, you know, so D is just a constant, 1 for the length of the series, 0 every place else, you get this red band up here, and it's kind of okay up here. But now if you take a polysferoidal wave function, it says multi-taper, that's not quite right, it's just a single taper, you get the estimate down here. And 30 or 40 years ago, I could have told you what a lot of these different peaks were corresponded to in terms of the manufacturing process. I remember this one around 8 and 9 and 20 cycles per meter were from the roller straightener that made the tube. And this one out here, I think, was from the liner, but I don't remember, and a lot of the rest is just kind of noise. The thing that's different here, of course, which was behind Dieter's process, is between the straight Fourier transform of the sample, the periodogram, and these windowed ones, there's a factor of 10 to the fifth. This is on a log scale, so this is 10 to the minus 10. This is 10 to the minus 5. Well, if this one gave acceptable performance, but in fact nature said, well, I don't know anything about the taper, I'm going to give you that one, the system wasn't going to work. And so this is why management was nervous. You know, if you're off by a factor of 10 to the fifth on your loss estimates, That's a pretty expensive mistake. So, and there was another problem, and that was with these windowed estimates, and that was that the basic, you could show one was better than the other, but the only theory for why it was there before was that John Tukey said it's a good idea. Well, I don't know how many of you knew John Tukey, but that's actually a pretty good reason to do things. He was a pretty smart cookie. I had time series from him. But there was a lot of opposition, and this one from Berg's thesis at Stanford, saying, well, taking the data, tapering the center up and the ends down to nearly zero, and, you know, it's all equally valid data. He says, yeah, no justification. So people weren't happy with this. There were quite a few other papers with similar comments. So a little more of this history. Well, 1977, the waveguide project ended, and I moved to a cellular phone project, but I wrote up some of the papers for Bell System Technical Journal and how we'd been doing things. There was a workshop on spectrum estimation, because lots of people were having similar problems at the Rome Air Development Center over across the lake. And so I put in a paper which had Carhoun and Loeb expansions in the frequency domain to look for periodic terms, which turned out to be Pauli spheroidal wave functions in the time domain, because of course they're their own Fourier transform. And so, and there were several of them. And so I knew that this idea of putting multiple papers on the data series worked, but I really didn't know why. I had kind of a hand-wavy argument, but that was about the best you could say for it. Then 1978, Dave Sepian published the part five of this series on Pauli spheroidal wave functions, which were the discrete ones. And I remember reading that paper, standing in the stacks in the Whippany Bell Labs library, and kind of everything gelled. Ah, that's the key to the whole works. And so we now call these Pauli spheroidal wave functions, gets to be, especially discrete Pauli spheroidal sequences, gets to be a bit of a mouthful. So we now just call these Sepian sequences, and their Fourier transforms are Sepian functions. And I'd asked Dave about this, and his first reaction was, oh, this was a little pretentious. And then I saw him a week or two later. He'd actually retired at this point, and he said, yeah, that'd be kind of nice, come to think. So that was interesting. So then there was a acoustic speech and signal processing workshop at McMaster in 1981. And so 1982, the main paper in this spectrum estimation and harmonic analysis was published, and Simon Haken, who was at McMaster, was kind of a guest editor for Proceedings of IEEE, which is where it appeared, and it explained why you need several papers and a lot of the tricks you can do with things. And the spectrum estimation, by the way, kind of refers to the continuous part of the spectrum, the harmonic analysis to the periodic terms. They don't have to be harmonically related, just periodic. So anyway, the way this works is, like everything, once you see it, is amazingly simple, is you take Fourier transform with available data, and I just centered it here in T-bar to get rid of a few phase factors. So it's just take the data, X of T, Fourier transform it. So Y of F here is still a sufficient statistic. So you can take the inverse Fourier transform, go back to the time domain, you haven't lost anything. Then you take the spectral representation, plug that in there, switch integration and summation, and you find that the Fourier transform of the data is just the convolution of a Dirichlet kernel with dx. And a lot of the times, I think the only thing I really contributed, instead of saying, well, it's just a convolution, let's call this an integral equation, actually a Fredholm integral equation, which is what it is, and try to solve it. So Sepian functions have, give or take a couple of phase factors, same end of kernel here, so should be familiar. The only change is they're orthogonal from minus W to W, also orthonormal in minus one half to one half. And so you choose a center frequency F, and whoops, there should be an F naught here. So then solve an F naught minus W F naught plus W. So do a turn the crank solution on an integral equation. So you have to normalize by the eigenvalue, take the data y at f naught minus chi times the Cepheid function, integrate to get the eigencoefficients. Do a couple of lines of algebra in here, which I'll put in. And you find that, in fact, the eigencoefficients are the data multiplied by one of these Cepheid sequences and Fourier transformed. So you can say this is Fourier transform of data times a taper, which is exactly the form Tukey had suggested. Or, in fact, another useful way is take the data, multiply by e to the minus I2 pi ft, so it just switches the frequency f down to the origin, and then do an orthogonal expansion on it in terms of the Cepheid. And they're extremely narrow band functions, so that captures that. And the important thing is you take this bandwidth w and their k, which are 2nw sequences. So that's the reason you need more than one taper in the data. And as I said, the first one is kind of Tukey's direct estimate. So these are some Cepheid sequences. Just k equals 0, that's the center one, looks like a Gaussian. And that's the one everyone had been using as a taper, at least everyone being me and a couple of other people, just single taper. And then the other ones, of course, k equals 1 was the first one I tried besides the zeroth one, and it has a zero at the origin, so it split all the lines, and the rest of them just look like a standard orthogonal series. And then these are the Fourier transforms squared. And as you can see, remember these are designed to optimize the energy in a given frequency band. And here it's 6 Rayleigh resolutions wide. And so the top here is about 100. And this is 10 to the minus 10. And the black curve is off the bottom here. But so you can see, in fact, they are amazingly concentrated in frequency. And in the continuous time case of their own Fourier transforms, and have lots of nice properties. So now we take the going on to spectrum estimates. We can write an approximation of dx as just an expansion of dx at f plus chi is the eigencoefficient at f times the Cepheid function at chi. And we need a d chi to kind of add things up. It's an odd kind of approximation. Typically, dx of f is not even differentiable. It's a very messy orthogonal increment process. And so here we're approximating it. Oops, wrong button. Sorry about that. And a series of entire functions. So anyway, take the average power in f minus w, f plus w. You need a 1 over n to convert energy to power and average over the bandwidth. And you get just the eigenvalue times the coefficient, or the eigenvalues are almost 1 or almost 0. And almost is the energy outside the band minus w to w. So, you know, 1 minus 10 to the minus 10 or 1 minus 10 to the minus 15, whatever. And so, I keep hitting the wrong button here. So when you have these, they're each one of these is the form of a direct spectrum estimate. So that's chi squared with 2 degrees of freedom. You've got k of them, so you've got chi squared 2k degrees of freedom, which in fact gives you a consistent estimate of a spectrum. So that's a nice thing to have. And so just kind of a map. Start off with a, where are we, mid-course check here. Finite sample from a stationary process, take its Fourier transform, invoke the spectral representation. We get a Fredholm integral equation, so no unique solution. Of course, you get that, you have to know the whole series and still an expected value. So just carry on and do a least square solution The eigenfunctions are the Stepien sequences and functions. And the eigencoefficients are the Fourier transform of the data times the taper. Now the next trick is to do an engineering or statistics regression problem and say, well, I've got part of this is signal, part of it's noise. Signal part is the local that is within F minus W, F plus W, and then take the rest of it as the noise, which is the broadband bias. That's the part of the Fourier transform that comes from frequencies outside F minus W to W. So basic approach in those is bound and ignorable. And then the local part, you get lots of tools. There's an F-test for periodic terms that we'll talk about. There's quadratic inverse, which expands things in a series of other series of related functions, coherence, and so on. And just a quick comment here, the other side of the Fourier transform, of course, is nominally equivalent or autocorrelations. So if you look at the basic definition of an autocorrelation, expected value xt plus tau, x conjugate at t, well, it implies quadratic scaling. It gives you non-negative Toeplitz matrices and modulation covariance, which simply means if I take x of t, multiply it by e to the I omega t, that comes outside the covariance function. So McWhorter and Scharf showed that this implies that an acceptable estimate of autocorrelation is multi-taper. Now, not necessarily Stepien sequences, but just something that gives that. So if you take the Stepien sequence 1 and Fourier transform it, you get x of n times the Stepien sequence and the delayed version times the delayed sequence. So it's basically, Alan, with the important 1 over k out here, so you get the average of the autocorrelations of x of n tapered with the n. So this is a very odd kind of estimate, or at least from conventional viewpoints, it's odd. And if you look at the autocorrelation, it, of course, has a Fourier transform. So you can say the spectrum estimate is the true spectrum times S hat over S, so estimate divided by the spectrum. Very profound, that step. And so I can say this is S times G, which is the spectrum times 1 plus delta G. And one of the things Bartlett noted back in his book on stochastic processes, I think came out in 1960, is he said you have to remember that an observed autocorrelation always exhibits less damping than the theoretical, which was kind of a strange thing. So the sampling properties of autocorrelations are generally a mess. And so anyway, if you now look at this equation, just Fourier transform, the estimate of the spectrum is Fourier transform of an estimate of correlations. And so it's the true autocorrelation, just the S of F times 1 here, plus the autocorrelation convolved with the Fourier transform of delta cap G, which is delta little g. And you can show that the expected value of dg squared is 1 over n, so it converges. 1 minus tau over n, so that's just a delay, so it eventually goes away at the sample size. And then the sine, just sine 2 pi w tau over 2 pi w. And if you take the old Bartlett autocorrelations, which are ones that I think 99.9% of the literature still uses, they just x of n, x n plus tau, and then when you, that's Fourier transform of the periodogram, and it's missing this sine x over x term. And that makes a big difference. Just remember I showed you this waveguide diameter, and I put a multi, this is a Bartlett correlation, so it kind of wanders around forever. And if you look at a multi-taper estimate, it's pretty different. It damps off quite quickly here to basically nothing. And mind you, this was computed long after the waveguide project was over. So, and now if I show you a simulation where we actually know what the true correlation is, this is the Bartlett estimate in black. And it, there's 1,000 samples in the simulation, so it rattles around. And this is part of the statement that there's less damping than the theoretical, so it goes on all the way out. The true autocorrelationist process was just an ARMA 4.2, damps off at about 200 time delays. And the multi-taper estimate is here. You can, same data, you can hardly tell them apart. So it, that sine x over x squared term, the Faye kernel, really damps things off rapidly. And so this seems to give a much better estimate of the correlations than the than just a simple estimate goes. And of course, a simple estimate where it's Fourier transform of a periodogram. I've taught it when I was at Bell Labs. I taught a course at Princeton, and one of the homework problems I gave the class was go to the library, choose a major statistic journal, and see how many issues you have to look back to find some joker using an unwindowed periodogram. And it was typically about 4 or 5, I forget the exact number, but less than 6, I think, in almost all the major journals they looked at. And so, you know, this is kind of an embarrassment because Lord Rayleigh knew the periodogram didn't work well. And not only knew it, but published it at least 3 times. So anyway, a little more of the personal history, how did this stuff come about? 1983, someone noticed the Bell System Technical Journal papers on the waveguide spectrum and invited me out to Scripps as a Green Scholar. So that kind of started the transition from being mostly an engineer to mostly interested in scientific things. They were worried about normal mode seismology and the Earth and all those kind of problems. Those are fun. Then the next year, I made a move from the cell phone area to communications research theory department, which was Shannon's department when he was at Bell Labs. And a little more randomness. Somebody else, let's say life is very random. Somebody at Scripps did a review of an NSF proposal, and they suggested to John Embry, who at Brown, who was the geologist, that he ought to talk to me about how to analyze his data. So I did that, and that was kind of fun. I got interested in paleoclimates and played with them for a while. And the one of the interesting things is, of all the things I ever did at Bell Labs, this saved AT&T the most money. So if you want to know the interest of AT&T in the climate 600,000 years ago, it's kind of hard to make a strong connection, but it still saved them $2 billion. Because when they had a production problem on the lasers for the first transatlantic fiber cable, I knew how to analyze the data. And, you know, because in a paleoclimate data, you get data as a function of depth and not as a function of time. So you kind of have to sort out the time scale along with everything else. And they had problems with the lasers, so I invoked a program I'd been using on the paleoclimate, and they got the plot of what was wrong with the lasers with, you know, time and thousands of years crossed out, and, you know, so on. So when you're working at what to do in research, work in what you're interested in, and that's where the money comes from, is otherwise you get better buggy whips. So next random thing that, next random thing that happened was a summer student, Cynthia Kuo. 1990 was a fairly good year. There were 2 papers on climate came out in Philosophical Transactions, one on paleoclimate and one on Holocene climate, and then one with Cynthia in and a postdoc that I had, Craig Lindberg, came out in Nature, looking, showing there was actually coherence between CO2 and temperature. And of course, that was a fairly short record. It went from 1958, when they started doing the detailed CO2 measurements at Mauna Loa, and obviously stopped at 1989 or so, when we had the last of, you know, data from, to write the paper with. So, and the thing, of course, that's interesting about climate is once you get into it, it's easier to get into it than it is to get out of it. And so There was another paper came out by Frisk Christiansen and Lassen, and which said, oh, if you take the period of the sunspot cycles, it explains all the increase in temperature, and you don't need CO2. And so I got, I think, 5 or 6 copies of that paper, including one from my boss, who handed me his copy of Science and said, did I believe this? So I took that as a great excuse to go away and play, and so we'll see a little more about that one later. And now part four, I'm going to do a very short review of climate, just a couple of examples, and talk about this harmonic F-test for periodic components. And this is always one of the things that people have done in spectrum estimation, is all the early papers were looking for hidden periodicities. If you look back at Schuster's paper in 1896, he was saying, well, you know, there's several papers now where people have computed these things that I'm going to call periodograms, so he named it. And he said, they're not doing the statistics very well. So it was already, I think 1871 was kind of the first place where people were making the transition away from just a Fourier series into something that we would now call a spectrum estimate. And Schuster was complaining, so they're always looking for bumps in the spectrum, and do you call this a peak, or is this from a line, or is it just a random bump? And so you take a stationary, a stationary process, you add a cosine to it, or in most cases, lots of cosines, and so that's what you get, and you now take the eigen coefficients at F, and it's the coefficient of the stationary series plus a Slepian series, or Slepian function at F minus F naught times a phase vector and amplitude. And so assume the vocal spectrum is locally white, so it's constant in F minus W, F plus W. Usually that's a pretty good approximation unless you have very limited amount of data. And then this F-test is simply the energy explained by doing the regression and getting these periodic terms divided by the residual energy. That is, take Y and you make an estimate of that term and see how much is left. So, and when you look at climate data, there's an awful lot of silliness in it. This is one particular example. This is levels of the Nile River from 622 to 1284. There are records that I kept. They're not always optimum. And the paper that looked at it said, well, you know, the dating might be off by a year or two because some of the records were damaged and been several changes in governments. But things have changed very little. The reason they kept track of the level of the Nile is they used it for taxing. So if you had a high flood, lots of silt, you tax the farmers more than if there was a very low flood. So, you know, taxes are always around. So raw data and inches and date. And this has been claimed to be long memory, in quotes. So the correlation doesn't damp off, and so kind of a power law or inverse power law at the origin. And if you compute the F-test for that, what you see at low frequencies are half a dozen peaks here above the 95% level. So in here, first harmonic Le Bon cycle, 712 years, 230 years Suess cycle that you see in carbon 14. Glaisberg cycle shows up all over climate. This one, 28, shows up in the solar physics literature. It doesn't have a name yet, but it's definitely been noted. The Hale magnetic cycle, the period's not exact, but then there's a dating on the series, so I'm not too worried. And then the 18.3, or what really should be 18.6 year lunar tidal cycle. So I figure if you look at it, you get 6 things, 5 of which are well enough known to be named. This kind of gives score, I think, is Newton and classical dynamics 1, and the Koplexology literature gets 0. So I've looked at several of these theories that have claimed to be long memory. None of them have ever been. And the only justification for saying this was long memory, which is the periodogram, which, as I said, Rayleigh knew didn't work. So climate, I was just to summarize some of these things. We had fluctuations in CO2 and temperature are coherent. One of the things that was kind of surprising in that 1995 science paper, in fact, quite surprising, was that the annual temperature cycle has a different period from the normal tropical year, which is what, of course, the calendar year goes on. And there's a little drift. And in particular, the Central England temperature series, which is the longest one we've got, starts in 1670, follows the general precession constant. And that is extremely odd because the only thing in the neighborhood that doesn't precess is the sun, which says that the solar wind must be controlling part of the seasonal timing. So that's an odd one. And the other one you can look at is that in there that is that solar irradiance does not explain the temperature changes. If it did, then you would see the average temperature and the amplitude of the annual cycle going in phase. And in the early data, they used to go in phase, and in the recent data, they flipped and gone to 180 degrees, which is what you expect from all the model predictions for CO2. So that's one. So then, if you take the data and you correct it for precession, put in both CO2 and solar irradiance in just a simple little model, you get about a 10 sigma increase in temperature. The solar sensitivity is almost exactly what you would predict from Stefan Boltzmann law, so not a big surprise. If you put in just CO2 or just solar irradiance, you get a rotten fit. But you put in the both, and in fact, you get a pretty good fit. And CO2 sensitivity is about 2.15 degrees. I wouldn't bet too much on the 5, but 2.2 round numbers. For doubling CO2, that was in PNAS in 1997. And in general, you see lots of long-term solar effects showing up, and I'll show you one later, that there's a lot of short-period solar oscillations in both the average and the variance of the series. I'll just show you one of those. So anyway, a little more. So another accidental discovery, and that was solar modes in space. And so the solar maximum that occurred around 1989, 1990 was somewhat more active than usual. There had been a fair number of what management calls communication satellites anomalies, what anyone else would call a failure. So we were looking at those. Ulysses data at that point, and interplanetary magnetic field data, and charged particles, so electrons and protons, various things. And then about the same time, maybe a year later, they were noticing they were getting a lot of drop calls on cell phone systems, which of course were being sold by Lucent. So I got, since I'd worked on cell phones and I'd worked on solar stuff, I kind of got roped in on that and started seeing, gee, that these are the same frequencies we were seeing on Ulysses. The failed satellites don't tell you much except that they don't talk to you. It's a lot more interesting to use data from a scientific spacecraft. So 1995, with Carol McLennan and Lou Lanzerotti, we published a paper in Nature saying we were seeing solar, both P modes and G modes, which we'll get to in a minute, propagating out at Ulysses, which was any place from 1.5 to 5.4 AU from the sun at that point. And the next year, of course, we were vigorously attacked because everyone knew that the solar wind is turbulent and chaotic or fractal or what have you. And it will certainly destroy any periodic, well, one, you can't put periodic terms into a solar wind anyway, because they didn't quite figure out how to do that. And even if you could, the turbulence would wipe them out before you got to 1 AU, never mind 5 AU. And just to put things slightly out of order, 2009, Ron Gosch and Lou and Bill Matthews and Lou and I published a paper saying, well, in fact, if you do MHD simulations, I should add that Ron Gosch here is head of scientific computing at the Applied Physics Lab, and so has a fair amount of compute power available. Discrete modes propagate just fine. And of course, when people were claiming this in 1996, they were mostly from NASA, and they were doing the best simulations they could of MHD, but it was basically a 2D, you know, or reduced MHD, so you get rid of one of the space dimensions, and of course everything does go turbulent. So, but then you do it in three dimensions, and that's, I think, as everyone in mathematics knows, two dimensions isn't the same as three dimensions. You get quite big surprises when you go from one dimension to two dimension to three dimension. You don't want to extrapolate too much from one to the next. And then kind of the last of his personal history is 2009, I got a two-year Killam fellowship to do research on these solar modes. So I've been back having fun with data from ACE and Ulysses. So, let's see, I'm probably talking way too long here. Little bit helioseismology, there's several families of modes. The two most important ones are pressure or P modes, which are basically acoustic standing waves, and they bounce around the surface of the sun, and you get resonance. They've measured about 10 million of them. So they're not too hard to detect. We could measure them out on Ulysses, and they lined up very nicely with the optical measurements. And then the ones that I've been very interested in are these gravity or G modes, which are a buoyancy, so you get fluid that's lighter at the top of the core, and then, you know, some gravity tries to pull it back down. And the way to think about these is take a cake pan or something. You know, I'll put in a layer of oil and a layer of water and then start an oscillation going on the interface. And if you do it carefully, you can make it oscillate. And if you use, you know, something with the right viscosity, it'll do it all weekend once you get it going. And the surface will stay still because the surface is flowing this way, but the on the interface, the fluid's going this way. Now, all you have to do mentally is wrap that on a sphere and imagine the same process. There's no accepted G-mode detections in the literature. There's lots of papers saying, oh, we've got them, but no one agrees with anyone else's, and so we'll have a little look at that. And like everything on a sphere, it's a spherical harmonic description, so you get three quantum numbers. There's the number of radial nodes, and L is the number of nodes in latitude, and M in longitude, and just the convention of spherical harmonics, L less than M, less minus L less than M, less than L. So each LN mode has two L plus one singlets. And so you'd like to detect these. And this is about the, if you can measure the properties of G modes, it's about the only way to find out what's actually going on in the core of the sun. And you know, at the moment we know kind of that the neutrino flux more or less agrees with physics, except there's a paper just came out in Astrophysical Journal late last year or earlier this year that says, well, maybe when you look at the evolution of the solar core, the neutrino flux should be different from the previous predictions. So I think that one may still be up in the air. And so these things are kind of the holy grail of helioseismology. They're maximum in the core. One problem is they're equally spaced in period, so when you get to low frequencies, they're very densely packed. The fundamental scaling for the spacing in period, you don't quite know that. There's some reasonable guesses from the P modes, but that's about as much as you'd want to say. The rotational splitting by the solar core is unknown, so you get F, L, M, and N is just F, N, L plus some splitting times M, and take M as plus for prograde. And the value of R and L here depends on both the rotation profile and the modes. You've got to estimate it. There's also a lot of theory that says, well, there might be multiple splittings in the sun. And one of the things that's come out is that you get extra splitting from a spacecraft orbit. So some more problems. Lots of theory, no repeatable observations. That's one. So GOLF, which is a helioseismology instrument, probably the best of the lot on optical helioseismology on SOHO. SOHO is out at the first Lagrange point, so it's a high-grade set of optical instruments that watch the sun. And so Ulysses, we get good spatial resolution, but it takes it about 6 years to do a latitude scan. And you get limited ones, about plus or minus 7.5 degrees with A's. Now, when it comes to something as basic as how fast does the sun's core rotate, you can find perfectly competent, papers by competent solar theorists saying it's got a fast core, which is kind of what you expect, because the solar wind carries off momentum from the surface, so you expect the surface to slow down just to conserve momentum, and the core, of course, is most of the mass, so it keeps spinning. But you can also find people saying, well, in fact, maybe it's slow. Error bounds include retrograde, so going backwards from the surface. So it's, so toss a penny, anything from backwards to 10 times surface speed or thereabouts. Then you have theory that says the GMOS frequencies depend or vary with their radiance, internal solar magnetic fields, anything from basically none to where the magnetic pressure blows the sun apart, which, of course, is since it hasn't blown apart that we've seen, that kind of puts a bound on them. The chemical composition, which was just extensively revised, the PMOG frequencies used to agree with composition and now don't. And then there's a lot of stuff we don't know about WIMPs, magnetic monopoles, stuff we haven't thought about. Dick Cheney's unknown unknowns. Maybe that was Rumford. And then the one of the things is these GMOs are supposed to have extremely high Q, which stands for quality factor, of someplace around 10 to the 11. And that's been interpreted as meaning that frequencies are very stable. Well, I'm going to invoke a statistician, Martin Wilk. He's head of Statistics Canada at one point, and also at Bell Labs at one point, and at Princeton for a while. And he said, the hallmark of good science is it uses models and theory, but never believes them. So more GMO problems. Well, these are fairly simple ones. The Quest for them started in the 70s. And in fact, what they've been calling it now is the Quest, because you get papers that say, oh, we found one, and, but then they can't reproduce it. Data gets sampled at 50 seconds or a minute, depending, some of it down at 1 second. You have, of course, missing data. You've got outliers from solar flares and coronal mass ejections and all these things. The occasional state you've got, for example, ACE is at the first Lagrange point, so it's pretty much straight between us and the sun, so you're aiming a high gain antenna at the sun to get the data from ACE, and if you have a radio flare, well, you just lose a few samples. And so you have to compute the power spectrum from 5 or 10 years of data, and normally I'll sample it down to about 16 minutes for looking for G-modes. Next problem is there are thousands of G-modes, plus then you throw in the singlets, and that's a really lot of them. And so the basic spectra are complicated, and when you put in all the splitting, the spectrum kind of looks like grass. So here's some of the grass, just to, I won't try to show you too many of these, but frequency in microhertz. Now the highlighted line, and this spectrum, I should say, is the spectrum of the proton density or solar wind density measured by the ACE spacecraft out at the first Lagrange point. And then these yellow lines, that are highlighted, well, the actual dotted ones and the yellow bands are just so you can see them a little easier, are six candidate frequencies from the Gulf instrument on SOHO, also at L1, has more problems than ACE, including the year vacation when its gyros failed and so on. And the frequencies are known, well, I published them to 10 nanohertz or 0.01 microhertz. And so we get six matches on these above the 99.9% significance level. So that gives you a chance of just dumb luck of something like 10 to the minus 15. But so I think we can say now that G-modes are detected. You know, that's pretty low probability hit by chance, but not yet identified. So we know we're seeing the same frequency as the optical people with, you know, pretty decent agreement. And so now we'll go on to the problem of identifying them. This is a L equal 1, N equals minus 3 G mode. So this is the raw spectrum, again, fairly grassy, and it's these three peaks, which we'll go through here in a little more detail. So this is the M equals minus 1 peak. What you see, this is the 50% significance level. The green curve here, which I hope you can see, is the width of the spectra, the effective width of the spectral window. So the mode is a little wider than that. The two bands here are plus or minus 32 nanohertz, which is a cycle per year. One of the useful numbers is a year is pi times 10 to the 7th seconds, to reasonable approximation. And when you look, a lot of the spectrum here is down between, this is the lower 5% point and the 99% point. So a lot of the spectrum's in here. This might actually be some high L mode. And the peak, the top of this peak is about 1 part in 10 to the 8th of getting for chance. So the top line I drew here is 10 to the minus 6. That's only 190,000 samples. So chance of it being by dumb luck. So now we go on and look at some of the splitting. Modes are, of course, as I said, spherical harmonics. So that's approximately. The sun isn't perfectly spherical. Solar wind flows radially outward. If you look at the Y10 spherical harmonic, it's C and some constant times cosine and heliographic colatitude. And so it has a zero in the solar equator. Now the ecliptic, where ACE and the Earth are located, is tilted 7.5 degrees to the solar equator. I think it's better to that way than saying the sun's axis is tilted 7.5 degrees on the ecliptic. It's pretty massive and doesn't much care about the ecliptic. And so what you find is the odd parity modes, that is the ones with L plus M or odd, are split by plus or minus a cycle per year. They get an extra scaling factor of sine 7.5 degrees, which is not all that big. And the phase difference is locked to the Earth's orbit, but don't take that too seriously because the sun's asymmetric north-south, and the orbit's also elliptic, which gives you another splitting, so we won't worry too much. So here are the two peaks. Again, remember the other one was up here someplace, so they're definitely lower power than the M equals 1 singlet. They're split plus or minus 32 nanohertz. I think there's a couple of other ones from ellipticity here. And again, most of the spectrum is down. When you plot the spectrum on this kind of scale, the peaks actually can be seen as something, a peak on a more or less benign background. And so this is the third singlet, M equals plus 1. Again, single peak up at about 10 to the minus 6 probability, and, you know, more stuff down at low levels. Okay, so how do these agree? Well, estimated center on this mode is 147.792 microhertz. If you look at the theory, 150.5 for Goff in 94, 153.7 Provo in 2000,
And so these are all solar, and then math are 153.3. So this is outside of this range of recent predictions of solar mode frequencies, but, well, it's, you know, theory, but again, there's a lot of things going wrong here in the theory, I think. And then when you look at the splitting, I get 1539 nanohertz. Very educated guess by Doug Goff in 94 was 1222. I don't know how many of you know Doug Goff. He's director of Institute of Astronomy at Cambridge, so, and specializes in solar physics. So that gets you the very educated guess. So here's another one. This is a L equals 2 mode, so the dotted lines here, there are 5 singlets. And again, the odd parity ones are split, but they're all above the 99.9% level. This is a little higher frequency. This is at 296 microhertz, which is pretty close to the center of the theoretical predictions. And also, there's a lot of peaks, of course, on here that aren't identified. That's an L equals 3, N equals 1 mode at 296.8, so center in here. And the theoretical one is 296.5. So getting some. So the next part is now to go to Ulysses. And so these mode identifications that I've made so far are all from ACE at the first Lagrange point. And but it's very easy to detect, say, an L equals 3 mode from an L equals 4 or L equals 5 mode or something higher, where not all the singlets are detected. And you find an awful lot of ways to do that. Observed frequencies at ACE are synodic, that is, we're going around the sun at one cycle per year, so they're offset, so by m times 32 nanohertz. Now, Ulysses is in a sidereal orbit, that is, its orbital plane is basically fixed. So here's just a quick look at Ulysses' orbital plane. This red dot is supposed to be the sun. This is plotted it from 2001, day one, up to 2002. You can see here it covered a lot of territory in 1 year. At this point, it was the fastest thing made by man, going 30-some kilometers a second at perihelion. And then it goes in this leisurely trip for 6 years to do the north to south part of the orbit. But of course, when you look, here we're at around 2 AU, we go up to 5.4 AU, back to 2.5 AU. So there's about a quadratic phase shift for, you know, finite propagation velocity, which says that the frequency has a linear shift on it. And then 2001 was just too fast. The modes are shifted so much that they collide. So you can't really tell much in that one. So instead of showing you a spectrum for Ulysses, which is again messy, start with this synodic frequency, offset them times m times 32, and so we're claiming we've identified them, so we actually think I know m, and if m is wrong, it won't work. And then you look for lines in the spectrum of data from Ulysses at that frequency. So complication is, as I said, the south to north pass is too fast. Distance changes from 2 to 5.4 and back to around 2 AU again. So you get an approximately quadratic phase or linear frequency, and most of the modes, as you go from north to south, go across nodal lines, so of course the phase jumps 180 degrees. So you get these phase jumps, which kind of kills the systematic part. But you can look where those are and try and match them up with the modes. And so out of 12 singlets for these L equals 2 and L equals 3 modes, we get 9 matches, 2 misses, and one that's kind of iffy, just looking at the radial part of the magnetic field. And one of the interesting things is this quadratic phase gives a propagation velocity which is about a third the speed of light. So it's zipping, it's the, you know, has to be one of the fast plasma modes, so it's zipping right along. Now, one of the other things that we find, I mentioned this in the temperature data, if we take some of the Ulysses data One of the things we noticed in the electron flux were some strong modes. One was at 1.11 microhertz, and so that's about 10.43 days. And this is the equivalent of the harmonic F-test for multivariate series. So this is looking at daily temperature data from Stockholm and Padua, which are two cities that have long daily temperature series, so over 200 years. And you get this nice, here's 99.99% level. And you see this in lots of data sets, and there's a lot of similar ones. And then the variance is even more complicated with interactions of these things. So, whoops, wrong button. And one other thing that's before we kind of summarize is this is looking at frequency shift with irradiance. This is, again, a solar wind proton density. And these are 0.9 years, so just about a year block. I chopped them off to make good use of the data. And you shift them along by 0.36 years. And the center frequency zero here is 219.59 microhertz, which are one of these Gulf candidate frequencies. And so the fit is the faster oscillation is this 1.27 year oscillation that's been seen on the solar tachocline, which is one of the internal boundary layers. And the 10.7 centimeter solar flux measured out in British Columbia. And so what you see is, in fact, the fit, the red here, has significant shifts, plus or minus 20 nanohertz or so. The shift in the mode frequency leads the Penticton data by about a year. So, yeah, this might be, everyone uses the Penticton solar flux data for calibrating their weather radar and military radars and all kinds of stuff, because you aim a radar at the sun, say, do we agree with, you know, tweak the gain control to agree with Penticton, and you're away. So, well, last thing on the solar modes, what went wrong? Well, probably first thing was the wrong observing frequency for optical. They're much stronger and better signal-to-noise ratio in particles. They've got better signal-to-noise ratio in radio telescopes. And certainly if you look at some other astronomical object in optical data, you often see a blur. You look at it from a radio telescope, and it's a nice, well-resolved thing. You look at it in ultraviolet, and it still looks different. So that's one. Poor analysis methods, bad interpolation through some of the data gaps. Spectra are mostly periodograms, so lines are too narrow. And of course, with the frequency shifting around, they don't work very well. You get poor sensitivity and high false detection rate, both. So probably taking theory too seriously. Assuming high Q implies high frequency stability, well, it actually doesn't. You can take something as simple as a swing, pulling or a ball on a string, and move the length of the string slowly, and the frequency will shift, but it keeps oscillating in the same pattern. And the other thing that was predicted is that the theory says the G mode should be attenuate rapidly with L as they come through the convection zone, and you get reasonable evidence for modes up to L equals about 13. So maybe that's taking. Well, the other thing, of course, is the other side of that is not taking theory seriously enough. You can make both mistakes. Theory predicts frequency shift with irradiance, which we certainly see going along with the Penticton data. And in fact, it was observed in the solar P modes about 1990. So, you know, they've known about this, but now it's high Q, therefore the frequency doesn't shift. So, certain amount of a not invented here attitude, lots of reinvention of analysis methods that people mostly know don't work. You look at the underwater sound people, for example, and they've done a lot of these things to a fine art. And so you can do that. And the thing that, from a statistical viewpoint, not enough exploratory data analysis.
you know, go take your data, look at it, look at the spectrum. Where do these peaks come from? You know, so that's mistakes. So same frequencies from optical helioseismology and instruments on ACE. We get FM from the 22-year Hale cycle. Shift in frequency in the modes leads the irradiance by about a year, and the mode splitting from the orbit. So we get some G modes are identified, not a lot so far, half a dozen, but again, all 2L plus 1 singlets, or if you count that splitting on the odd parity modes, 3L plus 1. Tentative detection to some modes with, you know, up to 12 or 13 or so. Well, agreement with theory is good at high frequencies. They were, you know, a couple of hundred nanohertz off the theory. Not as good at lower frequencies. And the splitting, again, says the sun's core is rotating rapidly at least three times the surface rate. And so overall summary, well, multi-tapers are a better way to analyze time series data. Climate, when you apply them to that, CO2 effects are simply too strong to miss. The only way you can miss them is if you're trying to. But it does have a very complicated stochastic structure, a lot of which you can find just by looking at the data. I mean, probably the worst thing you can do to it, which has been done lots, is to take this beautiful daily data and lump it into variable length monthly averages. That's not a good approach. Solar gravity modes detected and identified. We've now got some repeatable detections, and the sun has a fast core. Thank you, and hope you're not all asleep. So